Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here for the 33rd Eric Symes Abbott Memorial Lecture, being given by a distinguished and well-known performer and priest, and I'll say more in a moment. But Eric Abbott was dean here during the 60s and first half of the 70s and is buried just there. Before that, he was warden of Keble College, Oxford, and Richard Coles will give the lecture at Keble tomorrow evening. He was also at one time warden of Lincoln Theological College in the days when it existed and dean of King's College, London. Eric Abbott was here during the time when the 900th anniversary of the consecration of the second church building on this site was celebrated in 1965 and 1966. And there were many celebrations of one people during that febrile time. He was a distinguished theologian, and his friends initiated this series of lectures in his memory. And there have been some very distinguished lecturers over the years. Copies of this lecture will be available afterwards at the back, and you can see the list of those who've lectured during the years. Richard Coles is tremendously well known to us, not only as a vicar, but as a performer on radio and television. Who can forget his performance on Strictly? Perhaps I should draw a veil over that. And many of you will be regaled during your late breakfast on a Saturday morning with Richard's splendid introductions and interviews and so on. So it's a great pleasure and a great honour to be able to introduce to you this evening the Reverend John Humphreys, remember, the Reverend Richard Coles.
Thank you very much, Dean, for the welcome, and thank you very much, Dean, for the invitation. It's terrifying to see the list of distinguished predecessors who've undertaken this job. And then I realise that this was, in fact, every preacher or every clergyman's nightmare come true, and I look into the congregation and see such distinguished people. Oh well, simple country parson that I am, bear with me. Beating the bounds, parish ministry and spirituality today. Early in my church career, I was appointed lecturer at Boston Stump. The post was a hangover from the fractious days of the 17th century, when Puritans attempted to exercise control of parish churches by putting in their own men as second presbyters or lecturers. Archbishop Laud dealt crisply with them before they dealt even more crisply with him. Laud once visited Boston Stump, where one of his successors in the See of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, was one of my predecessors in the lecturer's stall. Ramsay was perhaps the most luminous clergyman the Church of England produced in the 20th century. And his little book, The Christian Priest Today, was very influential in the formation of Anglican parish clergy from the 60s. Although eclipsed, perhaps, in our very different world, it is of enduring interest, I would say, and it certainly had a big impact on me at Theological College 40 years after it was published. I felt greatly honoured when I arrived at Boston to sit where Ramsay sat and to talk to people who remembered him from those days. Mr. Fox, who'd sung in the choir for 70 years, was prepared for confirmation by him in the 1930s. "Wow, what was that like?" I asked. "I hated it," Mr. Fox replied. "We couldn't understand a word he said." The rather donnish Ramsay had been teaching in a theological college before he came to the Stump in 1937, where he soon became famous for his donnish, absent-minded ways. On one occasion, he realised he'd left home without his keys, so he returned and rang the doorbell. His housekeeper, a nervous woman alone in the house, shouted from the hall, "Dr. Ramsay is not at home," and he replied that he was sorry to inconvenience her and would come back later. This is not a story retold in The Christian Priest today, but I like to think that some of his experience at Boston informed his thought, and perhaps he acquired there the insight that the priest needs to be learned in order to be simple. I certainly discovered that the intricacies of the textual transmission of the Greek text to the Ephesians, so absorbing to me at that time, were not especially absorbing to the people in the pews, or not most of them, who wanted something that spoke directly to their lives and circumstances. They wanted a preacher who took them seriously. This is not to say that the history of the textual transmission of Ephesians is unimportant, nor that the people of Boston don't merit a decent sermon, but it needs to connect, not sell them short or elide difficulty, but connect. Rowan Williams, has there been a more learned successor to Ramsay, had the knack of doing justice to the topic, no matter how obscure or exacting, while taking his audience seriously, whether it was Regius professors of divinity, theology undergraduates, the Mothers' Union, school children, or Melvin Bragg. We need to be learned in order to be simple. One of the great blessings of parish ministry, I discover, is saving theologians from ourselves, making the learned simple, not by reducing the intellectually able to something less, but by obliging us to live and serve in mainstream life rather than specialist enclaves. I remember when I arrived at Findon, my present parish, going to see a parishioner who was dying in a nursing home. He had cancer, and it had been a battle, but by now he was on a morphine driver and in and out of awareness. He was rather a traditionalist, so I'd taken, with holy oil, a Book of Common Prayer to read from the Psalter, which I knew he loved. I read a selection, for when I got to the beginning of Psalm 131, De Profundis, "Out of the deep have I called unto thee, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice." He stirred and tried to say something. I pulled my chair up closer, and with great effort he said, "Shut up, you stupid prat." Actually, he said something else, but that's not for here. All priestly ministries adapt to circumstances. Between Boston and Findon, I was curate at St. Paul's Knightsbridge, a very different sort of parish. Postgraduate preaching, if I may call it that, was part of its weekly offering, as was enthusiastic ceremony and liturgical soundness. We knew how to do that and had the resources to do it effectively. Through building relationships of trust with people of means, we were able to fundraise, and millions of pounds found their way to charities thanks to our ministry. Much harder, I found, was finding ways of exploring with the people who lived there the things that troubled them, caused them anxiety, or offered unexpected hope, for they were sometimes lost to or obscured by the prestige of the postcode and the material rewards with which many who live there are especially blessed. How do you connect people to their deepest fears and obscurest joys when the world has already returned to them so flattering a reflection? The idea that something might be wrong is simply too elusive. One of my most enduring memories from that parish happened one night in the churchyard, which filled up in the hours of darkness with rough sleepers and the dramas they brought with them. The churchyard is overlooked by the Berkeley Hotel, one of the most luxurious in London, and if you were looking for a contrast in the fortunes of people in the same place and the same time, this would do very well. It was especially acute that night because the G20 was on and Chancellor Merkel was staying at the Berkeley. I saw her arrive with her phalanx of protection officers and staff, and she, clergy kid, looked over at the churchyard, and we looked back. How is that distance, 40 yards geographically, unfathomable politically, to be parochially processed? All points are equidistant from God, of course. Frau Merkel, in her suite, no more nor less in God's estimation than the meanest of the rough sleepers. But in order for us in parish ministry to make the worldly distance manageable we need to configure ourselves to God, to surrender ourselves in our narrow dimensions to the boundless grace, not to things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, but to grace. And we do that best through the discipline of prayer. Very often that's corporate, when we gather for worship on a Sunday or for a wedding or a funeral. The parish priest in this kind of prayer has a particular function as MC, or in persona Christi, a summariser of the concerns of the community, or as the one with the instructions. And as any religious functionary will tell you, I know this because I had exactly this conversation with the muezzin of a mosque in Cairo, making that work for others involves an element of sacrificing it for yourself. To enable others to engage in prayer, feed my sheep, requires a certain detachment, the detachment of a party host who sacrifices her own enjoyment of conversation and canapes so that others do not want for nourishment. Because of this, the nourishment and the challenge of private prayer are especially important for priests. It seems such an obvious thing to say that the life of a parish priest is to be nourished by prayer, but so often it isn't. Diligence in observing our canonical obligation to say morning and evening prayer daily, more easily sustained in theological colleges or cathedrals or great foundations or university chapels, is much harder to sustain if you have 20 minutes between a Section 48 meeting and Deanery Synod with six messages on the answer phone. Unmanageable demands on one's time has been the ruin of many a poor parson. But it's not only a quantitative problem, it's qualitative. Here's Eric Abbott. Whatever we may say about particular times and methods of prayer, this much is essential, that each day should have some dedicated silence in it. This is the gift of our time to God. We are to put ourselves at God's disposal in the quietness. The prayer will be dispersed throughout our day, throughout our activity, but there will be some dedicated spaces of silence. In my view, silence is essential to priestly prayer. It is its heart. By that I mean prayer that follows the conscious, and perhaps with practice, unconscious effort to empty space at the centre of our being in order that it may be filled. What a paradoxical enterprise that might seem. How can we empty ourselves? The emptied self is surely no self at all. I understand it to mean turning down the hiss and static of the world, the replayed interactions, the things that have irked us, wounded our pride, provoked our nosiness, indulged our silliness, and as they fade, to try to acclimatise ourselves to a silence in which God is heard. What does that sound like? Sometimes it is the ping of returning sonar, but returning in unexpected ways. What would Jesus do, we ask, but the answer is always not what we think. The counterintuitive returns of prayer agree. Nevertheless, it is striking how often, when we resolve to pray about something, it returns an endorsement of precisely what we'd already decided to do. Sometimes we do tune into that special frequency discovered among the hiss and static, like spinning the dial through weird shortwave radio stations and suddenly finding the shipping forecast, its accents clear and still. But most often it is just silence. I trained for ordination at the College of the Resurrection in Murfield, an Anglican monastic foundation where its students live as sort of para-monks, part-timers, following the monastic regime, but with Saturdays and holidays off. We may argue whether or not a thorough training in the correct use of the thurible at solemn evensong is essential to be a Fresh Expressions missioner in the Skegness coastal cluster, but enforced silence should be on the curriculum everywhere. First, it obliges us to silence ourselves, For some, like me, noisy in the world, that should be required by law. Second, it raises our awareness of how we communicate non-verbally. Very quickly, living in a monastic regime, you begin to identify people not by their speech, but by their tread, their breathing, their smell. Those who are expert in it become as perceptive as poker players, for the unconscious tells that reveal the strength of our hand, the weaknesses of our peers, when we're excited, when we're fearful. When I hear stories about Saint Jean-Baptiste Vianney, the curé d'art, patron saint of the parochial clergy, so celebrated a confessor he could tell what ailed a penitent before he even opened his mouth, I suspect he acquired that skill in the silence of the seminary, and tell it not in Gath, the supernatural ability of confessors to see into the souls of penitents, a familiar trope, may simply reflect the prosaic reality that people mess up their lives in predictable ways. And enforced silence obliges us to be attentive to others, to look for their needs without requiring them to tell us what they are. Silent breakfast, one of the great gifts of the monastic tradition to the world, obliged us to be alert for who needed the marmite when the milk jug required refilling, that our habit of slurping our coffee is experienced by others as a crime against humanity, and enforced a politesse, or at least a truce, which triumphed even over the seething enmities of theological college. Those enmities and what lies behind them, the obligation to confront our own sinfulness, are hard to bear. Silence again allowed for that necessary examination of self to be conducted, if not unflinchingly, then with regularity. During a particularly exacting period in my formation at Murfield, I found it necessary to rise even earlier than normal and get to the college chapel before matins to spend half an hour in silence with the Blessed Sacrament. A Romanian monk with us for a term had given me a metanoi, a knotted string, which, in desperation, I would pass between finger and thumb, reciting on each knot the Jesus Prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I recommend it. I might have become a monk myself had I not decided to double the dose and spend half an hour before evensong too. In the summer months, my meditative state was disrupted by the arrival of an ice cream van just beyond the monastery wall, which played the entertainer so jauntily and with so much distortion, it was like being shaken awake by the Swingle singers. I resented it at first and rained silent imprecations down on Mr. Whippy, but eventually began to look at it another way, as a call from the world beyond the cloister, where people eat 99s and sing along and live life in its fullness. It was a reminder, too, that silence is, of course, not the only thing that we should consider central to our priestly lives, our lives in ministry, our lives as Christians. It's always been necessary to evacuate the temple of our souls, of money changers and diversionary entertainments and self-regarding stratagems, so that we may make it our Father's house, but we are also, some of us, called to serve the world, to step into the noise that has never been noisier. Sometimes it's simply deafening. I don't know if you are familiar with TweetDeck, but I used to have it on my laptop for the 15 minutes before it became obsolete a couple of years ago. It allowed me to have on my screen as I worked, or avoided work, Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, Google Buzz, whatever that was, open simultaneously in a crowded perpetuum mobile. A news feed from the BBC sent notifications to my screen too. And if it had been something that had made sense to me, I could have had stock market figures scroll along the bottom too. It was a constant stream of information, a Piccadilly circus of relentless distraction. And the effect was not to enrich my understanding, but to impoverish it. It was like speed reading the Icelandic sagas. Glad to see recently some fight back in the jam-packed bandwidth of our digital discourse. Some young Quakers in Nottingham are putting silence online, the recorded silence of their meeting, gently, occasionally interrupted by the sound of a page turning, or a chair creaking, or a prematurely released snore. It's called the Silence Special, if you're interested, and you'll find it on a Young Quakers podcast. I like this approach, not to eschew social media as the work of the devil, but to find ways of pitching our tents in this risky new landscape. I feel I have some experience here. As a priest who makes his living not only in parochial ministry, but in secular employment also, I'm half-time, or rather half-stipend, vicar of Findon. I have an unusual hybrid ministry. It's both familiar, BCP choral evensong, deanery synod, mother's union, and unfamiliar. I work in the media and consequently have a reach which exceeds that of most parish priests. To what extent you can describe heavy Twitter use or being the background conversation to middle-class Britain's Saturday mornings or dancing the worst paso doble in Strictly history? That's true. As ministry is an interesting question, but for better or worse, I have become more widely recognised than is normal for my pay grade. One of the obligations laid on those who appear on radio and television is to maintain a presence on social media. It's become a sort of currency, which in spite of having a wildly imprecise value, everyone wants, like Bitcoin. Facebook was first, necessary when I became chaplain to the Royal Academy of Music, for it was the only practical way to keep in contact with students. Like many people over the years, for me, it's become a place of contact, for friends, for the exchange of ideas, for debate, and most of the time, it's evolved an etiquette adequate to the challenges of the medium. Not always. Twitter is much more difficult because the whole world is invited to join in. You can limit participation through blocking and muting, but I try not to most of the time, preferring to engage rather than ignore, although sometimes I feel like the idiot who keeps getting out of his armchair to answer the door to kids playing knockdown ginger. My followers, as they are called, people who choose to read my tweets, number about 160,000, which is 60,000 above the amount you need for corporate interests to come after you, offering money in exchange for you tweeting your enthusiasm for using their products, something I've never done. But it tells you something of the influence Twitter is seen to have by people whose business it is to use influence. Perhaps more significant than its impact as a tool for the marketing of products is the influence of social media on the flow and perception of news. Indeed, those two elements, marketing and news, have come together in ominous ways, as we discovered when the scandal broke surrounding Facebook's relationship with Cambridge Analytica and its alleged effect on the US presidential election and the suspected use of Twitter in Russian cyber ops to the same end. Even more ominous, perhaps, I'd argue, is Twitter's significance in framing debate. It does this in ways that are obvious. The storm of indignation it can provoke so quickly and so powerfully that it can put down the mighty from their thrones in under 48 hours. And more subtly, more and more journalists spend more and more time monitoring Twitter rather than going after stories in the field for reasons of cost and convenience. And consequently, arguments and advocates best adapted to Twitter come to shape the debate significantly. Twitter has waxed and looks set to wane, but by harnessing the power of the internet, it really has changed the world. Something else will come along in its place, and the cleverest and earliest adopters will take advantage of its distinctive technology. WhatsApp is a good example. But what's this got to do with parochial ministry? It depends on what you think constitutes the parish. Traditionally, it's a certain population of people living in the same place to which a parson is appointed on behalf of the bishop for the cure of souls. Over the years, civic and political significance, as well as spiritual significance, emerged in those relationships and structures. beating the bounds when the parson tore the edges of the parish and whipped children as he went to impress upon the community precisely where they met the edges of the neighbouring community, demonstrated how those interests aligned. Engaging with emerging media, broadcast, social, digital, is another form of this, I think, testing where the boundaries lie as we seek to maintain our witness to the kingdom in the structures of the world. I don't recommend whipping children as an adjunct to that, by the way. Sometimes this is simply a matter of adding our voices to a debate. Recently, I've been very much engaged with a Twitter row about the use of food banks. Our church, like many others, supports a food bank. I, like many parish priests, know people who use them, including one who's in full-time employment as a nurse in the NHS. But as a single mother with steeply rising childcare and housing costs, has found herself more than once using a food bank in order to feed her family. It scandalizes me that a trained nurse, highly trained nurse, in full employment, cannot afford to pay the rent and feed the family. And I said so on Twitter, which started a debate about whether people in full-time employment qualify as users of food banks. They do. And how typical they are of food bank users. Not very. And more broadly, what kind of a society do we want to live in? And how are we to fund it? To raise those questions is absolutely what parish priests do. And in my own parish, we have records of my predecessors doing the equivalent 200 years ago. Bishops, of course, debate these questions very ably at a national level in the House of Lords. But Twitter is, I think, in some ways more influential in that it reaches far more people and because of its power to shape national debates. It can also shape local debates. My ministry in Findon has other boundaries too. I've been on the board of our local housing association for 7 years and am now its patron. It started with a transfer of social housing stock from the local authority to a social enterprise to bring the energy and know-how of the private sector to create and sustain public benefits. All things considered, it does it very well. And we've not only upgraded our properties to improve the lives of our tenants, but have been able to build houses and flats to meet soaring demand. It's not in my official job description as Vicar of Findon, but instead of just wringing my hands about the housing crisis, I'm actively involved in putting parishioners and local people into houses. And my public profile allows me to advocate for social housing nationally in these straitened and politically hostile times. That Twitter reach and media profile has also led to my appointment as the Chancellor of the University of Northampton, an upgraded collection of vocational colleges in local specialisms, leather technology, early years education, the automotive industry, nursing, social enterprise, so that my parishioners and others in the county and region can achieve qualifications to gear up careers in their respective fields. Early years education has also been a priority in the parish, where we've sold land belonging to a church charity and with the proceeds built a nursery school so that children in the parish who have had very different outcomes in our VA primary school, depending on background, enter school more levelly equipped to engage with learning. There are other ways in which Twitter can align the things of the kingdom with the things of this world. For example, it's become a custom for me on Good Friday to tweet the Stations of the Cross. Only I don't use traditional iconography, but news photographs from the previous year that strike me as illustrative. I found that inviting others to follow Jesus' walk from judgment to burial, using imagery that begins with a death sentence handed down to an opposition politician in South Sudan and ends with the burial of a victim of Russian-sponsored bombing of Syrian rebels in Douma, affects and moves them in unexpected ways, especially, I've found, people who are not even remotely religious, let alone churched. I think it has an impact partly because it makes spirituality, and by that I mean the apprehension in this world of the things of the next seem not entirely irrelevant or abstract or quaint to many people who would usually regard the Church of England and spirituality as unrelated categories. I think it also expresses an immensely powerful and distinctive idea that human beings are irreducible in dignity. We are created in the image of God, who, in spite of our extraordinary failure to understand that, empties himself to become one of us and save us from the worst we can do. To look unflinchingly on the lowest, most degraded, most despised among us, and isn't that, and insist that it is God looking back at us, is our way, in a way, our most distinctive offer to a culture in which humans are routinely treated as numbers, human resources, cost occasioning liabilities, units of economic production, data streams, and at worst, collateral damage. The reason I have many followers on Twitter is because I have access to mainstream media. On Radio 4, Saturday by Saturday, after nearly 10 years, I have become a minor part of Middle England's breakfast time, like smashed avocado on sourdough. And through television, on panel shows like QI and Have I Got News For You, and the heavily formatted primetime shows like Strictly or MasterChef, I am the novelty vicar of the moment, although the admirable Kate Bockley is sure to eclipse me ere long. But it is as one of the Godslot regulars on Chris Evans' breakfast show on Radio 2, Pause for Thought, that priestly ministry is perhaps most recognisable. We contributors are invited to write a script of 300 to 400 words on something timely and of note, and to deliver it live at the end of the programme to the 10 million or so tuning in. I have in the past resolved to avoid the God slot for fear of being marginalised, but that was a mistake, judging from the reaction Pause for Thought gets from the audience, more mainstream than Thought for the Days on Radio 4, and better disposed, I'd say, to hearing religious people talk shop than the Today programme's listeners and presenters. A tricky consequence is that it brings to my inbox unmanageable requests for pastoral care. Technology allows us to speak directly to millions of people, but returns via email needs we cannot meet. It's a notable property of radio that it sounds with peculiar intimacy in the ear of a listener and encourages a very personal feeling of connection with the speaker, which can elicit intense irritation as well as sympathy. I try to deal with this as best I can, to refer inquirers to their local clergy, but that may not be what they want. There are other pastoral demands that arise from within the places I work, where inevitably one becomes a sort of unofficial chaplain. Sometimes this is to care for colleagues in bereavement, and I have on occasions acted as a sort of translator, standing between a family with religious expectations and colleagues and friends and partners with none. I've also been involved in disputes at work, and am currently helping run a group which is fighting changes forced upon us by the clumsy determination of tax, which fail to understand the reality of freelance work in broadcast media. Hostile headlines complain this is the moaning of millionaire tax dodgers. But the reality for the vast majority of people who are affected by this is that they're not well paid, with penury, and the reality that faces them is penury, thanks to unforeseen and, in our view, unlawful and unjust tax demands, to the extent that they're losing homes, risking their mental and physical health, and obliged, again, to use food banks to feed their families. That's a recognisable, if unauthorised, form of parochial ministry. Putting labour disputes to one side, my work at the BBC, co-presenting Saturday Live, while not preaching from a pulpit, is, I hope, continuous in some ways with a parish priest's calling, in that it seeks to elicit from people their stories, especially people whose stories have not been heard before, even if the demands of the form require that story to be delivered, even chivied, in 5 minutes, rather than the hour I might spend with someone who came to see me in the vicarage. I also like the way it treats, on more or less equal terms, the famous and the unfamous. Harder to see the continuity between parish ministry and Strictly Come Dancing, although church fates have inflicted plenty of dreadful, if less widely displayed, indignities on clergy. Have I Got News For You is tricky too, a bear pit where politicians and comedians contend. And if you are neither, but signed up to the Mission for Reconciliation, you have to be very careful. You could, of course, just say no, and I do to many things, but I try to find ways of saying yes, partly because media careers require constant stoking, partly because narcissism is a hungry beast, but also because I think it's valuable to have a place in the mainstream. Say yes if you can. It's also absorbing to try to find ways of being authentic to our calling while alert to the possibilities and risks of operating in these new environments. In this, I feel like a missionary of the 1880s, sitting in the back of a canoe, heading up country into the unknown, the BCP in his bag, the jungle pressing in with strange and threatening sounds, even if in my case that would more likely be the theme tune to I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, than the battle cry of a Bugandan warrior. This may look like I'm trying to have it both ways, trying to make sense too easily of an unshifting paradox. There is, after all, a tried and trusted way to be a parish priest. Just be one. One of the more difficult truths of my performance in the role is that I'm not around as much as I should be. How do you fit it all in? People ask endlessly. And the truthful answer is by letting people down and neglecting important things. Michael Ramsay again. The gospel you preach affects the salvation of the world, and you may help your people to influence the world's problems, but you will never be nearer to Christ than in caring for the one man, the one woman, the one child. His authority will be given to you as you do this, and his joy will be yours as well. And his forgiveness will be required too, for the times we've failed to care adequately. There's some consolation in knowing I'm not the only one. The parish priest is always caught between irreconcilable demands to be the good shepherd, the tireless missionary, to preach in and out of season, to be silent, to be heroic even unto death, to be the self-effacing servant, and so on. I think often of the example of George Herbert, who walked away from power and glory and a career in the Jacobean court to become a simple country parson, the rector of Bemerton, for 3 short years before his death from consumption. We know this from the recollection of his friend Nicholas Ferrar, who set up the experimental Christian community at Little Gidding, not far from my parish, and from the wonderfully readable, but perhaps not wholly reliable, memoir by Isaac Walton. You may argue why he took that path, and how hagiography and the expectations of readers tidies the mess of his or anyone's life, and what boon it is to one's priestly reputation to die before you make a total mess of things. But his example is powerful. Not as powerful, however, as the body of work he left, his poems, and for which he is rightly remembered as one of the greatest priest poets of his age, or any age. As a parish priest myself, I think the peculiar energy of his poetry comes from the paradoxical existence, Christian discipleship, priestly vocation, mission, parochial responsibilities obliged him to live. The ultimately unbearable tension of being called to a perfection we can never attain ourselves. With Sir Thomas Wyatt's rather workaday poem about strumming a song of unrequited love upon his lute, surely in mind, Herbert strummed his, not in a lament of love unreturned, but in celebration of love fulfilled. Awake, my lute, and struggle for thy part with all thy art. The cross taught all wood to resound his name, who bore the same. His stretched sinews taught all strings what key is best to celebrate this Most High Day. From George Herbert's Easter, gut under tension, braced wood, to suggest the song of glory arises from the cross, that those unbearable paradoxes arrive at their resolution. O crux, ave, spes unica. O hail the cross, our only hope, as the great Passiontide hymn, Vexilla Regis, insists. I was involved with the television series Rev, a serial comedy which told of the life of a parish priest in a failing central London parish. Much of the comedy and the pathos of the series came from his struggle to maintain a faithful ministry amid the growing indifference of the world. To the surprise even of BBC Two, which made it, it was a great success. It surprised me too. And what I discovered that was while our doctrine and our liturgy and our place in the world may grow decreasingly interesting to everyone else, fascination with people who make the commitment to it endures, rises even. Why? Because the collapse of institutional religion does not mean the hunger it once provided for vanishes. It intensifies. Feed my sheep, our Lord commands. So we must seek the flock, wherever it may be, in obedience to that call.
As you already heard from the Dean of Westminster, Eric Abbott was Warden of Keble College, Oxford, where Richard will repeat that lecture tomorrow night, and Dean of King's College, London. And so it falls to me, as the current Dean of King's College, London, to respond to Richard and then to invite a few questions from the floor. If you've not read Richard's autobiography, Fathomless Riches, I commend it to you. It is a full and frank account of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and theology, faith, and spirituality, brutally honest about all of them in equal proportions. And he writes movingly of his time studying theology at King's and singing in our chapel choir. And I like to think that some of the theology he learned there brought him to this wonderful evocation of the spirit of Eric Abbott, whose ashes, as the Dean pointed out, are buried just behind Richard. And I have to say that, unlike one or two of the lectures I've heard in the last 25 years, certainly tonight there was no sound of spinning coming from the grave. Richard, I appreciated that you began with the idea of ordination and that wonderful book by Michael Ramsay, The Christian Priest Today. One of the glorious things about Michael Ramsay was he was out of tune with his own time in the 1960s, and he's still out of tune with our time today. And of course, therefore, the book has not dated, like so many things that are relevant. I read it in the 70s, you read it in the 80s, and I still can't give it to the Ordinands at King's today. And then there was your account of parish ministry, evoking the memory of George Herbert and the angler Isaac Walton. And that wonderful commitment, quoting Eric Abbott himself, about the importance of prayer and silence at the heart of a priest, inspired by the memories of passing the Marmite at Murfield. We need to be learned in order to be simple, you said. And your lecture was a stunning example of both. You stressed the importance of communication at the start, but more importantly, you demonstrated it in this lecture. Witty, a light touch, lovely stories of the sort that those of us that do follow you on Twitter and Facebook are used to. and yet with real depth, your desire to communicate the riches of God's love to the people of Findon, to those who listen on Radio 4, to those who watch QI or Have I Got News For You, the Big Painting Challenge, MasterChef, and even those who still can't erase from their memories that Paso Doble in Strictly. On one previous occasion when you and I were doing something together, you were described as teetering on the brink of national trinketdom. The title you gave to tonight's lecture, Beating the Bounds, sounded limiting. And traditionally, of course, it was, however, the way that the parish priest would take the gospel right to the round the very edges of the parish, to those on the margins, literally. And I think tonight you've shown us that the heart of Christian ministry is still the prayer and silence that Eric Abbott taught at King's and here, and also how to communicate it, to take it beyond the bounds of parish ministry, to those who live on the margins of church and society, who live on the edge, and still communicate the all-embracing love of God. And for that, we thank you. Now, we have a couple of the inevitable roving microphones. If you would like to ask Richard a question, please wave your hands and we will come in due course to people at the front and at the back. So if we go to that gentleman there first, and maybe before you start, if somebody in this block would like to wave a hand, and we'll take the second mic to you so we'll be ready to, for the next one. Anybody on at the back on this side? Nobody at the moment. Okay, well, sir.
I'll ask a long one. My name's Simon Webb, and...
can you make sure you speak into the microphone, please?
Thank you. Yeah. My dad, who was a parish priest, was actually had as his mentor Eric Abbott, as did my mother, actually. A longer story to be told there. And I remember that when after he came up here, which was rather boring for me, because I used to have to sit in the deanery while they talked, that my father was more assiduous about having half an hour in the morning of silence, but also about being more active in looking after the spiritual welfare of his curates. He was a great curate trainer, and I think Eric Abbott used to prompt him to do them. So my question really is, who looks after the spiritual welfare of the parish clergy nowadays? You may not need it, but I'm sure some do.
Very excellent question. I think the biggest shift in my experience of ministry was going from curate to incumbent. I'm perhaps one of the last of the Mohicans in the sense that I had two curacies. Started off in Boston in Lincolnshire with a wonderful training incumbent and a team ministry, and then a wonderful incumbent in London with great colleagues too. So I went from Murfield and the very corporate experience there to two other churches where we were a body of praying people and a body of priests to being on my own. That's a very big shift, actually. And not only being on your own and having no other priests around as a kind of daily companions, except, well, I'm civilly partnered with one, but that's another story. Also being on your own in the way that you are when responsibility is yours, when it's your show. And that's quite tough and quite lonely, actually. The rudiments of a disciplined prayer life acquired at Murfield, I think, have been resilient and helped me very much with that. But what I think I have learned that's been fantastic is I've learned to share priestly stuff with lay people. I have a fantastic team of people. I have a wonderful reader. I have another really fantastic reader in training. I have two retired clergy, and I have three ordinands at various stages of the game. So there's a group of us working together in ministry, and we've kind of adapted, I think, the tunings, as it were, of me being part of a kind of college of priests to that. That's been really good. And also, hot off the press, I have my first curate coming next month. So that's really exciting. So what I'm hoping to do is that will kind of help to sustain and build up the priestly prayer life in the parish. Although, interestingly, she's got a non-parish-based ministry, a work-based ministry. So we're probably just as likely to be meeting over a cappuccino in Costa in Oxford Circus than we are in the choir stalls of St. Mary's Findon. That's typical, I think, or not untypical, of how many people do that now. I have a spiritual director, one of the monks at Murfield, whom I don't see often enough, but I'm very grateful when I do. And there are, of course, my partner's a priest, and although he's not involved in the life of the parish, apart from answering the door to the kind of footfall, he keeps a kind of monitoring eye on what I'm up to, or not up to. A priest who played a huge part in my formation. One of the reasons I'm a priest is because I saw other people make it look possible. Even when I was at my most antipathetic towards the church and thought it a gobbledygook and hostile territory, there were people who just seemed to do it with integrity and honesty that hugely impressed me. And one of them was John Gaskell, who many of you will know, who was vicar of St. Albans Holborn, which is the first church I started going to. I remember that actually because today, being the day in which the Church of England remembers John and Charles Wesley in its calendar, I had a Wesleyan conversion. My chains fell off, the light flooded in, my heart began to beat. Only I had it in St. Albans Holborn, the only person ever to have a Wesleyan conversion in that particular church. But I do remember with John, who was the very pattern of a priest, and although he's no longer living, or not in this world, I think he made a huge impression upon me. One of my favourite moments was, I was once the subject of a documentary by the BBC, who made an hour-long film about me, presented by Fern Britton, about Marvellous, Marvellous Me. And to pad out this hour, inevitably they had to find other people to talk to, which required a lot of phone calls from me from people who needed a bit of persuading to add lustre to my reputation. We had everybody we needed, apart from someone who was around at the period of my conversion, which was in my late 20s. And I thought of John Gaskell, a pattern of a priest to me, someone of great integrity and holiness, wit, humour, imagination. And so he'd then retired. So they said, well, phone him up and see if he'll do it. So I duly phoned up John Gaskell then in retirement in Morden College. And he said, oh, hello, Father, how are you? I said, I'm very well, how are you? He said, yeah. And I said, the BBC are making a documentary about me. And he said, oh, how can I help? And I said, well, we need someone who was around at the period of my conversion to tell that story. And I can't think of anyone who's better placed or better able to do that than you. And I wonder if you'd consider doing it. And he said, oh, my dear Father, I would so love to help you. Tiny problem. And I said, what's that? He said, I don't remember anything about you. And I like to think that that's a little bit of priestly sustenance to keep me going.
And a footnote to that, of course, is that on Eric's gravestone here behind us, friend and counsellor of many, Pastor Pastorum. We'll be coming forward, Richard. Somebody back there, I think I saw it. Thank you.
Hi there. My name's Basil and I was at Keble myself, so it's great to be able to come today rather than tomorrow, because I'm not there anymore. As a relatively young person myself, I was wondering how important you think technology is for getting young people into the church, and whether over-reliance on social media and technology can sometimes be to the detriment of the rich parts of the liturgy, such as the Book of Common Prayer, which you're so much a fan.
Very excellent question. I think we have to go. It's an absolutely characteristic hallmarks Christian history from the word go is the early adoption of new technology, the codex, printing, radio, and now, of course, social media. So to get on there is really good because it connects you to people. One of the great things about Twitter is it connects you to people in ways which get round the assumptions or the caricatures that people may have in their minds about church and church people. That's really good. But it's only good as a kind of whipping in, I think. Inevitably, you have to get people to experience the transcendent mystery of God alongside other people. So the notion of kind of an app for the Eucharist doesn't really work for me, but as a kind of way of getting people connected, expression of ideas, then that's really good. But in the end, it is about bringing people together to experience the transcendent mystery of God, and I don't think there's a shortcut to that.
I'm Catherine Pappinster.
Hi, Catherine.
Hello. I wondered if you think that we live in a Christian Britain or a post-Christian Britain. When I watched the royal wedding last weekend, in many ways we still seem to be a Christian nation. We had 20 million people watching a Christian church service. But the response to Bishop Michael Curry's preaching was a very positive one. But what really struck me about it was how many people said, I didn't know people were like this in churches. If people were like this, I'd become a believer. This is not what I thought church was like. Which suggested that a lot of people not have rejected Christianity, but are completely oblivious to it most of the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think Michael Curry, perhaps knowingly, did every preacher for Pentecost the next day a great favour, because I, and I'm sure half the people here in Alderman, went on about the fire of God's love. I loved it. I thought it was magnificent. I thought it was fantastic, and I thought it connected with people in ways that other people, you know, it reached the parts that other preachers don't reach. That's not to say it's better. It's just to say it did something. I think he rose to the occasion. 1.9 billion global audience for that, 20 million, as you say, in Britain, sniggering, passing beneath the millinery in the stalls, perhaps, but that doesn't matter at all. I can't think of a sermon that's excited so much comment and touched so many people. I can't remember another one, certainly not in my lifetime. And I think that's wonderful. I think what's wonderful about it is that it allows us to recover some confidence in the core message of what we're about. I think we've got into a habit, really, having our relationship of trust with people having, in lots of ways, broken down. I think we perhaps lost confidence in that. And to return us to something which absolutely announces to the world, proclaims to the world, the weird peculiarity, the paradoxical fire of love, I think is a fantastic thing. And what it tells you is what it confirms to me what I've long always suspected, I think. The hunger in people has not diminished. The hunger that, for me, only got satisfaction when I stepped into the doors of a church for the first time and came out not as a spectator but a participant, that hunger endures. And we have to find ways of giving people a menu in a language they understand, I guess. There are other things to say about that.
For those of us who know Bishop Michael, I do a number of things in the States. I have to say, that was the shortest I've ever heard him preach. And it was the most static. I think they must have nailed his feet to the floor, because normally he just goes walkabout for about half an hour. As the Dean said at the start, this is tonight the 33rd Eric Symes Abbott Memorial Lecture, and it was Lord Harries who set up this sequence of lectures when he was Dean of King's, following Eric Abbott's passing. And so I think it's entirely appropriate we should let you, Richard, have the last question tonight.
Well, Richard, thank you very much indeed for such an excellent lecture. We're very grateful for that. I think I'd like to know practically how you cope with social media so that it doesn't totally overwhelm and take over your life. I mean, I've got a rather sensible, thoughtful grandson who from time to time won't have a mobile phone or will switch it off. You obviously have to be totally immersed in that world for some of the time, but how do you manage it practically so that it doesn't totally take over?
Thank you. By becoming more expert at it as I go along. So I'm really quick now. I can get a tweet out in 10 seconds. And I find that Twitter, for me, is most active when I'm in what would otherwise be sort of dead time, in the queue at Sainsbury's, on public transport. That kind of works for me. Facebook is a bit different because it tends to be a more developed conversation. The really important thing, though, is fasting. So I don't use social media in Lent, apart from tweeting Stations of the Cross on Good Friday. I just come off it completely. And then every once in a while I have a fast. and that's kind of good. I think the other thing about it is to evolve. I think one of another things we do, being the people we are, doing the things we do, is we can contribute to creating a humane culture around it. Often it's really simple. It's people shout at you on Twitter all the time, and if you don't shout back, sometimes that can reset a conversation in a way which is really interesting. Finding ways of putting out the fire, not of love but of hate, in Twitter is a kind of interesting thing and an evolving thing. But I think fasting is the most important ingredient in that. So I just wanted to one thing, if I may. I do think about Michael Curry's sermon. What I really, really liked about the sermon was it was preceded by the Dean of Windsor. I thought the Dean of Windsor, for me, was just as memorable. I thought the way he did his thing was fantastic. Completely different from Michael Curry. It was the fact that it was both of them, that Michael Curry was at home in that setting. I thought that was the most remarkable thing about it. Thank
you. Since this is church, two quick notices. You will have found on your seat the wonderful news about next year's Eric Abbott lecture on the 9th of May here in the Abbey. Sir James McMillan, the very distinguished composer, conductor, artistic director, will be speaking to us on the subject of spirituality and music. Some of you will remember last year's wonderful lecture on spirituality and literature from Sally Vickers. We've had spirituality in the parish tonight from Richard, so it'll be spirituality and music this time next year. So do take that, put that in your diary. As was mentioned, it was such a stunning lecture, and there is so much more depth in it. So please do take one of these home with you. They are available at the back for a simple price of £2, and you will help the secretaries in my office enormously if you buy them, because otherwise they will have to lug them back to King's. And there are also copies of previous lectures available there at a ridiculously knockdown price of only 50p. And all the lectures and more recently recordings are, of course, available on the Westminster Abbey website and on the King's College London website. But it remains only really to once again ask you to give thanks to somebody who told us tonight, "Feed my sheep, our Lord commands. So we must seek the flock, wherever it may be, in obedience to that call." Ladies and gentlemen, the Reverend Richard Coles.